For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Judges chapter 7. Well, if you remember last week, just to recap for those of you that missed it, last time we saw the Midianites invade. Each week we've been studying the book of Judges for the past month or so, and we're transported back to a time over 3,000 years ago, a time that is considered the Dark Ages in the history of the nation of Israel, where the people had rejected God's leadership in their lives. There was a serious lack of spiritual leadership, and every person did what was right in his or her own eyes. So it was a time of moral anarchy. And we see the cycle repeating itself again and again, and we saw the beginning of one of these cycles last week, where the people forget about God, and then God allows a foreign nation to come in and conquer them. Last week it was the Midianites, a nation located east of Israel. And so the Midianites came in, and we saw the devastation was pretty severe. They would just, every year at harvest time, they would come in and just devour the land like locusts and then go back to their homeland. And they were causing the Israelites to fall into deep poverty and starvation. We saw God then selected a man named Gideon. So Gideon to the rescue. He was a pretty fearful guy. The first time we see him, he's in a wine press threshing wheat. He knew a few things about God, and yet he was kind of a conflicted man. He had a lot of doubts about, is God really the God I've heard about? Can God really save us? Is God really with us and with me? How can God deliver the whole nation through me? And we saw that God was patient with Gideon. He answered his doubts. He affirmed him. He gave him action steps so that he could step out and see God come through, and therefore just be even more encouraged and place more faith in God. And so by the end of last time, we see Gideon has gained a tremendous amount of confidence and trust in God, and he's ready to spring into action. So we're going to start at the end of 6, where we left off. Judges 6:33. It says, soon afterward, the armies of Midian, Amalek, and the people of the east formed an alliance against Israel and crossed the Jordan, camping in the valley of Jezreel. So they crossed the Jordan River, and they've invaded once again, just like they do every year. They'd probably heard about Gideon, and maybe were a little bit worried about him. It says, then the Spirit of the Lord took possession of Gideon. Well, we've seen this before. The Spirit of the Lord comes upon a judge. This is where Gideon goes all Incredible Hulk and becomes this different person to lead the people to victory. He blew a ram's horn as a call to arms. Brrr. And the men of the clan of Abiezer came to him. And he also sent messengers throughout Manasseh, Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali, summoning their warriors, and all of them responded. So he puts out a call to all of northern Israel, and the people respond. Thousands of men begin flocking to Gideon from every village, every mountain, every town, every household. All the warriors came to him, and by the time it was all said and done, there was 32,000 men that had assembled, ready to follow Gideon, even to their deaths. And it's at this point that Gideon starts to get second thoughts. Gideon said to God, if you're really going to use me to rescue Israel as you promised, prove it to me in this way. I'll put out a wool fleece on the threshing floor tonight. If the fleece is wet with dew in the morning, but the ground is dry, then I will know that you are going to help me rescue Israel as you promised. So he gets a little science experiment together to see, is this really true? And, you know, he's thinking, God, what are you doing here? Are you really going to come through? Are you really going to rescue Israel through me? How am I going to lead this? I mean, he sees all these people coming, and he realizes this is for real. How am I going to lead them into battle? You know, am I just like the Pied Piper playing my ram's horn as I march these men to their death? Or are you really going to do something here? And so he sets up a little test. He says, this is the way that I'm going to know that you're real. And so he does something that, many Christians have practiced themselves today, and that would be he puts out a fleece to see, is God really going to come through? Fleecing God. This is something that many of us here may have tried. You know, what this basically means is where you say, God, if you want me to blank, then prove it to me by doing blank. We set up a little test. We say, God, if you want me to, you know, go to this college, date this girl, take this job, whatever, then I want you to prove it to me. And we set up, you know, usually we don't do something totally supernatural like Gideon did that defies the laws of nature, you know, like make my cell phone levitate or something like that. It's more like, I pray that you'd make the next 4 stoplights turn green for me. And if, you know, we go through the first one and the heart rate starts to get a little faster and we go to the second one, we're like, oh my God, is God really going to come through here? Or, you know, we're like, if this is from you, God, then I pray you'd give me a text message at 9:25. And if he does, then boy, that must be God. God must be in this. You know, and this is, I think, particularly attractive because we're at a time, a lot of us are at a time in our lives when we're making major decisions that are going to affect the rest of our lives. We realize how little we actually know about which end is up, and we're confused and scared, and so we want guidance, we want direction from God. And so it's, you know, Gideon did it, and maybe I should do it too. Well, it's a bad way to learn God's will. Putting out a fleece, these little signs, these experiments we set up. For a couple reasons. For one, this is not even how Gideon used it. Gideon was not trying to figure out what God wanted him to do. The way he found out what God wanted him to do is he had like an hour-long conversation with this angel that God sent, where he explicitly told him, here's everything I want you to do. And then he heard from God on several occasions after that. So, you know, Gideon was not, he was not trying to figure out what God's will is. He was asking for courage or strength to go ahead and actually follow through on God's will. Because this was a pretty major thing that God had asked him to do. Although, you know, really, he should have had enough information. He'd already had plenty of signs from God on this. But, you know, this is not how Gideon was using it to figure out God's will. He was using it to get courage to do what God had already revealed to him. Another reason is it usually doesn't help that much. Let's read on here and see what God does. It says, that's just what happened. When Gideon got up early the next morning, he squeezed the fleece and wrung out a whole bowl full of water. And Gideon said to God, please don't be angry with me, but let me make one more request. Let me use the fleece for one more test. This time, let the fleece remain dry while the ground around it is wet with dew. Which would have been harder. You know, if the fleece, you know, if the fleece could have just soaked up a bunch of water and then the sun burned off the dew and then the fleece is still wet. It hasn't dried out yet. But this is harder, you know, for the fleece to be dry and the ground to be wet around it. So that night, God did as Gideon asked. The fleece was dry in the morning, but the ground was covered with dew. So God, he answers this sign, this test, two consecutive times. But like I said, it usually doesn't help that much. As we see, it's easy to doubt this stuff. You know, Gideon, even after God did it exactly what he wanted him to do, he was like, actually, I don't know. Now do this instead. You know, we get the text message at 9:25, but then we realize, well, I receive about 1,000 text messages per day. So that's really not that supernatural that I got one at that particular time. Maybe if I went 60 seconds without receiving a text message, that would be a sign that God really wants me to do this. That would be supernatural. So, see, you know, we don't know if that would have happened anyway. You know, maybe he's thinking, well, maybe somebody wrung out the fleece. Maybe somebody came overnight and used it to, like, you know, mop off their sweat or something like that. It's easy to doubt. And you also run into problems of partial fulfillment. You know, what if the first 3 lights are green, but then the next light turns yellow as I'm going through it? What is God trying to tell me by that? Some caution as I move forward? Or what if there's like a text message at 9:24 instead of 9:25? Does that count or not? I don't know, God. So, you know, it's open to interpretation. There's things where it's kind of partially fulfilled, and they usually don't give us that much affirmation anyway. I mean, you see Gideon had to do the same thing twice, and there's no indication that any of his fears were alleviated by this. We read just a few verses later that he's still pretty scared by this whole thing. Another reason why this is not it's a bad way to learn God's will is because it's putting God to the test. You know, Gideon even knows, I shouldn't be doing this. You know, he's apologizing. He's saying, God, please don't be angry. I just have one more test for, he even says, this is a test, you know. God, let me test you in one more way. And that was explicitly forbidden. It says, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. And the problem with these is it kind of, it really is viewing God like our science experiment. You know, we're making him jump through all these hoops like he's some sort of local deity that is just eager to have anybody follow him or worship him. And God is just, you know, we're not in a position to be telling God what to do. We have no idea how our signs are going to affect somebody else. And what God is doing in this larger plan. And so when we make demands and we specify what God is going to do for us, it's just a pretty arrogant position to be in. The amazing thing here, you know, this is not a model for discerning the will of God. The amazing thing here is that God actually responded to Gideon here. God was doing something big here, and so he's willing to work with Gideon's kind of semi-pagan notions of his deity. Just because he knew a bigger task had to be accomplished. If you do want to know the will of God, I've got just a couple brief points for you on this. How to find God's will. For one, it starts with a relationship. It's not some sort of impersonal letter that will self-destruct in 10 seconds. The will of God is formed in a relationship with God. And that is God's primary will for your life. The first thing he wants is he wants you to turn to him and to enter into a relationship with him. Because as we've seen week after week here, the whole human race is alienated from God. And we need to be brought back into a right relationship with him. And that reconciliation, that reunion with God, that relationship with God can only be forged not because, you know, we're like really good or we don't need forgiveness. It's because God provides forgiveness freely. Through the person of Jesus Christ, who lived a perfect life and died for sin to bring us back into relationship with him. And so it's almost like, you know, you're like a radio and your antenna is broken. You don't have any way to pick up signals. And you need to get back into relationship with God to reestablish that connection with him so that you can begin to hear from him and get guidance from him. So it starts with a relationship. Another thing we need to understand is that God reveals his general will to all believers. God has kind of a general direction, a general will for everybody who's in a relationship with him. And so, Gideon, he really didn't have much of God's revealed word. At most he could have had was six books of the Bible, because that's all it was, six or seven books were all that was written at this point. He probably had less than that. And so, he was working with the revelation God had given him through the angel, through the direct verbal communication he'd had with him. Fortunately, God doesn't need to do that with every single one of us now, because he's written down and approved and verified, this is from me right here, my word, scripture. And so we've got a tremendous wealth of 66 books worth of guidance and direction and from God about what his will is. And so really it's going to start with, it's got to start with you heading in the right direction. And so, you know, that's getting into the Bible for yourself. It's pursuing spiritual growth, doing the things that are going to make spiritual growth likely in your life. Learning how to love God, learning how to love other people. Those are the two great commands that God has for us. Love God and love others. And so how can I go about doing that? And so once you're heading in that direction, you're in a position where you can actually hear from God and see things clearly, and God can direct and steer you through a variety of sources. And that's the third point, is that God usually reveals specific direction gradually. Okay? It's very rare that at the beginning of your Christian life, God says, here is everything that you're going to do for me. I mean, he does that occasionally, like the Apostle Paul, he did that for him. But even that was still pretty general. This is going to require a willingness to follow. You're going to have to decide ahead of time that, God, if you show me something, then I'm going to do it. I'm going to follow you. I believe you're good. And obviously that also requires that we believe we need direction from God, that we're not just fine on our own, running our own lives, deciding what we're going to do, but we need outside help, direction from him as to the direction we should head. Jesus said, if anybody wants to know if my words are true, he said, you should be willing to act on those words, and then you'll know that this is directly from the Father. So it requires a willingness to follow. It's probably not going to be detailed predictions. again, I suppose there may be exceptions, but, you know, God is not going to give you like a movie reel and show you here's everything, here's the unfolding of your life before it happens. Partly, you know, for one, I think that would terrify us to see some of the things that God is going to have us do one day. We realize there's no way I can do that. It's because there's a process between here and there. It also would really reduce the need for moment-by-moment dependence on God, obedience to him. You know, if we knew everywhere we were going, it'd be easy just to take control and just to head off in that direction. If God's like, you're going to marry this person, and here's where you're going to end up, it's like, well, that pretty much affects how I relate to every single person of the opposite sex, doesn't it? It affects every decision that I'm making, and sometimes the journey toward where you're going, it's just as important as the end goal. It'd be temptation just to go on autopilot. Additionally, I think this would be kind of boring if God just revealed in advance what your whole life was going to be. It would be like you're just an actor in a play just going through the motions. You could feel fatalistic. It doesn't matter what I do. So he's probably not going to give you detailed predictions as he reveals specific direction for your life. And I really urge you to get input from godly people on this. People who obviously know and follow God and are becoming more and more like him. You know, in this story here, God's going to reveal the direction that the whole army should take, and the only person he tells is Gideon. And, you know, that would be kind of on the extreme end of things, but, you know, there might be times where God reveals his will for you through somebody else, a godly person that you trust, and we should be real open to receiving counsel from them. And fourth and finally on this subject, God is more committed to you than you are to him. Sometimes we feel this neurotic sense that I can't blink, otherwise I'm going to miss God's will for my life, and God is just... He understands you. He understands that just wouldn't work. I really like this quote from Blaine Smith, his book, Knowing God's Will. He says, on the one hand, it's clear from the Bible that we're to have a healthy fear about the possibility of our sin interfering with God's will. But on the other hand, it's equally clear that we are not to be obsessed with a fear that loses sight of the fact that he who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. The biblical picture of guidance is one of God's taking a person who has a basic desire for God's will, and working out a plan in that person's life which is realized to an important extent in spite of his or her weakness and sin. What this boils down to is that if our basic disposition is to do God's will in the first place, we may be confident that he will take us to the key points in his plan, even though we may reach them in a wayward manner. Our search to know and do God's will should be carried out in an attitude of tremendous security, not one of neurotic anxiety. And that's real encouraging to me, to know that God is more committed to making sure that I clearly see his will for my life. The story of Gideon is not about Gideon, you know, very diligently seeking God's will. It's about God coming after Gideon and saying, here's the direction I want you to go here, Gideon. God initiates with Gideon in the first place, and along the way, he puts up with Gideon's fearful attempts, really, to run the other direction. So we can be encouraged by that. If you're generally committed to knowing God's will and committed to following him, then he's going to find a way to help you see what the next steps are so we can relax. Well, apparently he got at least enough affirmation to move forward here. In Judges 7:1, it says, so Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, remember that was the name he got last week when he tore down that altar to the false god Baal. So Gideon and his army got up early and went as far as the spring of Herod. The armies of Midian were camped north of them in the valley near the hill of Moreh. So they were kind of uphill from the armies of Midian. The Lord said to Gideon, you have too many warriors with you. Gideon's like, what? Come on. I got 32,000. They got four times as many. 32,000 is barely enough to have a shot in this battle. And God's like, I know. That's why you got to get rid of some. Because you think you still got a chance at winning this thing. On your own strength. He says, if I let all of you fight the Midianites, the Israelites will boast to me that they saved themselves by their own strength. You see, God is really, he's not at all concerned with the size of the opponent. His real concern is with the pride of his own people. See, when God does something, he does it in such a way that he makes it clear that it was not our strength at all that saved us, that it was his strength alone. And, you know, the power of God, you know, there's no limit to what God can do if we're willing to humbly turn to him and depend on him. He says, therefore, tell the people, whoever is timid or afraid may leave this mountain and go home. So let's send home all the people that are scared. And so Gideon goes to his army, and he's like, apparently God thinks we have too many people. And so if there's anyone who's chicken enough to abandon Israel in her hour of need, you can feel free to go. Although I'm sure that we don't have any cowards, they're going to turn tail and run. 22,000 went home. Leaving only 10,000 who were willing to fight. So, crap. Loses 2/3 of his army right off the bat. The Lord told Gideon, still too many. Oh, man, what are you doing to me, God? Bring him down to the spring and I'll test them to determine who will go with you and who will not. Gideon took his warriors down to the water, and the Lord told him, divide the men into two groups. And one group put all those who cup water in their hands and lap it up with their tongues like dogs. So they're scooping and they're pulling it up to their mouths. And the other group put all those who kneel down and they drink with their mouths in the stream. Only 300 of the men drank from their hands, and all the others got down on their knees and drank with their mouths in the stream. And so Gideon's probably relieved at this point, thinking, phew, man, we only lost 300 there. Maybe God will stop releasing my troops to go home. And God says, no, actually, you just lost 9,700. The Lord told Gideon, with these 300, I will rescue you and give you victory over the Midianites. Send all the others home. So an epic battle with 300 warriors fighting against overwhelming odds. Gideon's certainly no Leonidas in this whole story here. But they've got God on their side. Maybe there's a shot. And again, like I said, God's central concern here is not how powerful is Midian. God's concern is, are you guys going to take credit for what I'm going to do? Because I know you people. I know how arrogant you are. I know how forgetful you are. I know how you just want to rely on your own strength and take credit for the things that I do. And I want to make sure there's no doubt in anybody's mind as to who saved Israel from Midian. I like how the Apostle Paul puts this same idea. He says that God said to me, my grace is all you need. My power works best in weakness. That's so true. God's power works best in our human weakness. Now I'm glad to boast about my weaknesses so that the power of Christ can work through me. That's why I take pleasure in my weaknesses and in the insults, hardships, persecutions, the troubles I suffer for Christ. For when I am weak, then I am strong. When I am weak, that's when I'm strong. Do you feel weak? That's a good place to be at. Because then you're in the perfect place to be able to depend on the power of God. And that's what God was doing here. He was doing this for his glory. He's doing this to expose Gideon's fears and to drive Gideon to God, to depend on him alone to win this victory. So Gideon collected the provisions and ram's horns of the other warriors and sent them home, but he kept the 300 men with them. The Midianite camp was in the valley just below Gideon. And that night, the Lord said, get up. A lot of things happen at night in this story. It's kind of weird. Go down into the Midianite camp, for I've given you victory over them. So now is the time to fight. But if you're afraid to attack, which you probably are, go down to the camp with your servant, Purah. Listen to what the Midianites are saying, and you'll be greatly encouraged. Then you'll be eager to attack. Which sounds like a good idea to Gideon, because it's either that or go fight. So Gideon took Purah and went down to the edge of the enemy camp. The armies of Midian, Amalek, and the people of the east had settled in the valley like a swarm of locusts. Their camels were like grains of sand on the seashore, too many to count. Gideon crept up just as a man was telling his companion about a dream. The man said, I had this dream. In my dream, a loaf of barley bread came tumbling down into the Midianite camp. It hit a tent, turned it over, and knocked it flat. He's confused by this dream. It's perplexing. His companion answered, your dream can only mean one thing. God has given Gideon, son of Joash the Israelite, victory over Midian and all its allies. Obviously, when Gideon heard the dream and its interpretation, he bowed down in worship before the Lord, and he returned to the Israelite camp and shouted, get up, for the Lord has given you victory over the Midianite hordes. So just to recap, God sent an angel to personally talk to Gideon about this. And then God affirmed it through a sign. He visited him four different times, sent his spirit upon Gideon to clothe him with power, gathered an army of 32,000 people, wet a fleece, dried a fleece, and torched 40 pounds of bread. And Gideon doesn't believe. And then Miss Cleo pulls this interpretation of this dream out, and all of a sudden he's freaking Rambo. But apparently this is what pushed him over the edge. He divided the 300 men into three groups and gave each man a ram's horn and a clay jar with a torch in it. And so these torches are they're lit and they're hidden under these clay jars. Then he said to them, "Keep your eyes on me. When I come to the edge of the camp, do just as I do. As soon as I and those with me blow the ram's horns, blow your horns too, and all around the entire camp, and shout for the Lord and for Gideon." It's just kind of weird. That last part is pretty strange. I mean, why? You know, I guess he's God's judge. Maybe, you know, they'd heard his name and there was some kind of intimidation thing he was going for. But, you know, this whole speech seems kind of Gideon-centered, doesn't it? I mean, look at that. There's not a whole lot about God in there. You wonder if the power is starting to go to Gideon's head. Well, it was just after midnight, after the changing of the guard, when Gideon and the 100 men with him reached the edge of the Midianite camp. And then all three groups blew their horns and broke their jars, and they held the blazing torches in their left hands and the horns in their right hands, and they all shouted, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon!" Each man stood at his position around the camp and just watched as all the Midianites rushed around in a panic, shouting as they ran to escape. And when the 300 Israelites blew their ram's horns, the Lord caused the warriors in the camp to fight against each other with their swords. So, you know, the Midianites, they just hear this loud shout. They hear the blast of ram's horns, 300 of them from all around their camp. They're waking up out of a dead sleep, totally surprised, totally startled. And it just throws them into confusion, and they begin attacking and hacking one another to pieces, thinking that the guy across me with a drawn sword must be the Israelites. And so they end up slaughtering one another to a large degree. You know, it really wasn't much of a battle. They just stood there and watched. I mean, it was more of like a death metal concert. You know, like a loud noise and then people trampling each other. Maybe setting things on fire. Those who were not killed fled to places as far away as Beth Shittah near Zerah and to the border of Abel Meholah near Tabath. And when Gideon sent for the warriors of Naphtali, Asher, and Manasseh, who joined in chasing the army of Midian. So he sends for these tribes. That's kind of interesting because those were the same tribes that God had just sent home. You know, you wonder where Gideon, God didn't tell him to recall these troops. You wonder why he did that. And when did God give him permission to recall these troops into battle? Gideon also sent messengers throughout the hill country of Ephraim saying, "Come down to attack the Midianites. Cut them off at the shallow crossings of the Jordan River at Beth Barah." And they captured Oreb and Zeb, the two Midianite commanders, killing Oreb at the rock of Oreb and Zeb at the wine press of Zeb. And they continued to chase the Midianites. Afterward, the Israelites brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon, who was by the Jordan River. And so, you know, God delivers his people. It's kind of interesting. You know, the story starts with Gideon hiding in a wine press. And at the end of the story, the opposing general is beheaded in a wine press. And his head is brought to the great commander Gideon. And, it'd be nice if this was the end of the story. I really wish that the story ended here. You know, maybe a verse about how there was peace in the land for many years. How, all the people tore down the altars of Baal, just like Gideon had done in his hometown of Ophrah. But that's not the end of the story. You know, as Gideon's standing there at the Jordan River, you know, watching these men come back to him with his exhausted troops right there, no doubt everyone extolling the praises of the great hero, the mighty hero Gideon, the valiant warrior, God's man, who's delivered these people. Something happened in Gideon's heart there. Gideon thought, that he wasn't quite done fighting yet. He realized he had some unfinished business that he wanted to take care of. And so Gideon presses on. It says in Judges 8:4, Gideon then crossed the Jordan River with his 300 men, and though exhausted, they continued to chase the enemy. When they reached Succoth, Gideon asked the leaders of the town, "Please give my warriors some food. They're very tired. I'm chasing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." So he's not just content with the commanders. He's going after the kings. The officials of Succoth replied, "Catch Zeba and Zalmunna first, and then we'll feed your army." So they're kind of playing it safe here. They don't want to help Gideon and then have him lose and then get trounced by the Midianites for helping out their enemies. You know, and really, their money here is still on Midian, that they're going to defeat Gideon and his small band of troops. Gideon says, "All right, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." From there, Gideon went up to Peniel and asked for food, but he got the same answer. So he said to the people, "After I return in victory, I'm going to tear down this tower," issuing threats. And you know, God never told Gideon to do any of this. God never told him to say any of this. God is strangely silent throughout this whole chapter. You don't hear from God again after Gideon crosses that Jordan River. You know, and it's almost as though the Spirit of God that had clothed Gideon before this battle just silently slipped off his shoulders at some point and into the background, and Gideon never heard from him again. By this time, Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with 15,000 warriors. All that remained of the allied armies of the east, for 120,000, had already been killed. Gideon circled around by the caravan route east of Nobah and Jogbaha, taking the Midianite army by surprise. Is it just me, or is this army, like, real easily surprised? Anyway, it says, Zeba and Zalmunna, the two Midianite kings, fled, but Gideon chased them down and captured all their warriors. And so after this, he drags these kings with him. He says, after this, he returned from the battle by way of Harith Pass. And there he captured a young man from Succoth and demanded that he write down all the names of the 77 officials and elders in the town. So he essentially, bullies this young boy into giving him the name of all the leaders there at Succoth that he threatened. And then Gideon returned to Succoth and he said to the leaders, "Here are Zeba and Zalmunna. When we were here before, you taunted me, saying, 'Catch Zeba and Zalmunna first, and then we'll feed your exhausted army.'" And then Gideon took the elders of the town and taught them a lesson, punishing them with thorns and briars from the wilderness. So he just went out and started whipping these men, grown men, with thorns and thistles. He also tore down the tower of Peniel and killed all the men in the town. So he's murdering now all the men in this town, just getting more and more extreme. Now, this is not the Gideon from the wine press. This is King Gideon. He's acting exactly like one of the other Canaanite kings. The brutality, the vengeance, the threats, the cruelty. And so finally, he's ready to deal with these two kings. You know, you can almost see him marching them out in front of his whole army, no doubt, bound tightly, forcing them down on their knees as an act of submission. And then he asks Zeba and Zalmunna, "The men you killed at Tabor, what were they like?" So he recalls a battle that was a long time ago where they had killed some men. And they said, "Like you," they replied. "They all had the look of a king's son." He says, "There's a reason they looked like me, because they were my brothers, the sons of my own mother," Gideon exclaimed. "And as surely as the Lord lives, I wouldn't kill you if you hadn't killed them." So we see what we've expected all along here. This is not Gideon doing the will of God. Gideon has hijacked the army of the Lord and he's using it for his own personal vendetta. This is not God's deliverance for God's people. This is Gideon's vengeance on Gideon's enemies. King Gideon's enemies. And turning to Jether, his oldest son, he says, "Kill them!" But Jether did not draw his sword, for he was only a boy. He was afraid. And Zeba and Zalmunna said to Gideon, "Be a man. Kill us yourself. You're so strong. You're so powerful. Show us how strong you are, Gideon." And Gideon killed them both and took the royal ornaments from the necks of their camels. The royal ornaments from the necks of their camels. These were ornaments that the kings kept around their beasts that they rode on. And the Israelites, they said to Gideon, "Be our ruler. You and your son and your grandson will be our rulers, for you have rescued us from Midian." So they're asking Gideon to be their king now. But Gideon replied, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son. The Lord will rule over you." So it seems like a good response at first. But he says, "However, I do have one request, that each of you give me an earring from the plunder you have collected from your fallen enemies." And so he says, "Well, I won't be your king because God has got to be your king. But if you wanted to give me a bunch of money, I would take that." "Gladly," they replied, "they spread out a cloak, and each one threw in a gold earring he had gathered from the plunder. And the weight of the gold earrings was 43 pounds, not including the royal ornaments and pendants, the purple clothing worn by the kings of Midian, or the chains around the necks of their camels." If he doesn't want to be king, why is he keeping all the king's clothing, the royal ornaments, the pendants? And then Gideon made a sacred ephod from the gold and put it in Ophrah, his hometown. Soon all the Israelites prostituted themselves by worshiping, and it became a trap for Gideon and his family. And so Gideon takes this gold, these gold earrings, he melts it down, and he makes an ephod, which is some kind of a statue or some kind of a garment out of solid gold. And he puts that right back in his hometown. And soon all the Israelites, they prostituted themselves by worshiping it. And you know, this is really the last state is worse than the first here. You know, Gideon started out the story so strong, ridding his hometown of the Baal altar. And yet now by the time of the end of the story comes around, that the town is famous, a famous location where everybody can go and worship idols. You know, you've really got religious hypocrisy at its finest, don't you? Him saying one thing with his mouth that sounds nice, invoking the name of God, and yet deep down in his heart, he didn't believe any of it. He was definitely going to be king. You know, it says just a few verses later, he had 70 sons born to him. He had many wives, a whole harem of wives, just like all the kings used to have, with all these sons. He also had a concubine in Shechem who gave birth to a son whom he named Abimelech. Abimelech, which means "my father is king." You know, so just all the evidence lines up that Gideon, even though he says, "I want to follow God, God should be our ruler," actually Gideon was going to be their ruler. He was going to be king. And you know, it's funny to see Gideon early on in this story. He knew he was weak. He knew he was not a powerful man. And at that point, it seems like it was a lot easier for him to listen to God. Back when he was winepress Gideon, before he was King Gideon. And yet now, even though he's saying, "I'm not going to rule over you," deep down in his heart, he is. And you know, I wonder if some of us can relate to this. You know, on the one hand, saying, "God, you know, I need you. God is going to rule over me." But in our hearts, we're still king. You know, we've got our purple robes back in our hometown, our golden idols sitting on our throne while everybody comes to us. You know, that's what we really want. And what the Bible says is that's what the whole human race wants. We're constantly trying to take God off of his throne where he should be. And we're trying to get back right up there in his place. And if we're weak for a little while, if we're having problems, we might turn to God and depend on him. But in the end, when things are good again, we forget about God and we climb right back up there on the throne of our lives. And we might pay lip service to God, but deep down, we are the king. I like how Hosea 13 says this. It says, God says, "I cared for you in the desert in a land of burning heat. And when I fed them, they were satisfied. When they were satisfied, they became proud, and then they forgot me." And that's the story of the book of Judges as well. The people becoming satisfied and proud and forgetting about God. That's exactly what happened in Gideon's life. Gideon turned to his own strength. He took credit for what God had done. And that was his downfall. So let's think about just a few brief points of summary here in the story of Gideon. You know, one thing I think we've seen here is that we need to be willing to follow God. You know, wherever God leads, if God leads someplace pretty frightening, we can be sure that if God is leading us there, then that's a good place to go. That's actually the safest place to go. And we need to be willing to follow him, to admit our need for God's direction in our lives, and to head that direction, no matter what the cost might seem to be. And we see that in Gideon earlier on in this story. Reluctant, but willing to follow, knowing he needs God's guidance. Two, though, when you stop following God, you stop depending on him. You know, the point here is not we need to, like, try and whip up some feeling of weakness or pretend like we're weak when we're really not. You know, the truth is that we are weak. We do need God. But we tend to engineer our lives in such a way that we don't really feel our need for Him. We basically have everything under control. And when we follow God, God is the one that leads us to the place that we need to be to depend on Him. God is the one that led Gideon into battle with 300 men that enabled him to depend on God. And God will lead you into places in your life where you have no choice but to depend on Him. Where you have no choice but to turn to Him and ask Him for strength because you're terrified. And you don't know what you'll do without Him and you're afraid you're going to fall flat on your face. But when you stop following God, when you stop listening to Him, when you stop going where He wants you to go, when you break off from Him, that's when things start to get bad. That's when we start to rely on our own strength. We feel satisfied. We feel full. And we forget about God because there's no need for Him. I've pretty much got it under control. And third and finally, God leads you to your point of weakness so you can be strong in Him. You know, that was the point Paul was making in that verse I read from 2 Corinthians 12. That God had engineered circumstances in his life to bring him to a point of weakness. A point where he was beyond his own strength and he had no choice but to depend on God. And God might be doing that in your life. This evening, over the past week, over the past months, over the past years. Bringing you to a point of weakness where you realize it's time to stop fighting. It's time to admit that in spite of my strongest efforts, in spite of me giving it everything I've got, all of my intellect, all of my persuasiveness, all of my charisma, all of my talents, all of my education, all of my training, all of my strength, and it's not working. I'm failing. God, you are my only hope. That's a point that God will bring you to if you're willing to follow Him. And it's a good place to be. It's a safe place to be. Because you know how desperately you fought, how desperately you tried to do it on your own. And how in the end, God loved you, God was patient with you, and God was willing to answer your cry when you finally turned to Him and called out. And so if you're here tonight and you don't have a relationship with God, God may be doing this in your life as well, leading you to a point of weakness, leading you to a point of failure in your life, pulling back the curtain so you can see this is what happens when you try and run your life. And that God is standing there with the open arms of grace and forgiveness waiting for you to run to Him, to embrace you, and to call you His son or daughter. That's the offer He extends to you tonight. And then we've got the second part of Gideon's life. All right, why don't we pray? You know, Lord, thanks that we can be honest before you, that we are weak. And I pray that you wouldn't let us forget about that weakness, Lord, because those are the times when we're strong, Lord, it's just so hard to think we need any strength other than our own. So I pray that I thank you for the trials that you brought into my life and that you bring into the lives of people in this room to expose their weakness and to drive them to dependence on you, Lord. And I pray that we can say heartily with Paul that we delight in persecutions and hardship and insults and troubles and toils because when we're weak, then we're strong, God. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.